We've been exploring a lot about non-clinging. And continuing that this afternoon, reflecting on some ways that a person who does not cling is described. I'll start with description from a text called the It's found in a collection called the Sutta Nipata. This is really the entire Sutta of the Atthakavagga, collection of 16 poems. It's kind of a reflection on clinging and non-clinging. What a person is like who does cling, what their experience is like, what a person is like who has released clinging, and how does one move, shift from one to the other? I'd say most of the poems are kind of in one of those three camps in this sutta, this collection of poems, the Atthakavagga. Today, I'm just going to read one of the excerpts from one of the poems describing someone who is let go of clinging. Someone comes to the Buddha and says, "Having what vision, being of what character is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person." The Buddha responds, "The person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, not fretful, who gives wise advice, who is calm, restrained in speech, who is indeed a sage. A person who is not attached to the future, who does not sorrow over the past, who finds solitude amidst sense contact and is not guided by fixed views. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not greedy, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not arrogant, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous, who by nothing is repelled. A person who does not take on the training in hopes of material gain, who is unperturbed if they get nothing, who is not hampered by wishes and not greedy for flavors. A person who is even-tempered, ever attentive, who does not suppose that in the world they are equal, superior, or inferior, who is free of conceit. A person for whom there are no tethers, who, knowing truth, is not tethered in any way, and in whom no wishes are found for existence or non-existence. This is someone I call peaceful. They are indifferent to sensual pleasure. In them, bonds are not found. They have overcome attachment." One of the big things that stands out for me in this description is that it's largely what somebody is not. It gives a sense in this poem. I get a sense of what it might be like to meet such a person. You get a kind of a sketch of their character in a way. So it's kind of describing the person and what they are like walking, living, being in the world. But it doesn't really say what they are. It says what they're not. This actually, to me, is freeing to reflect on when things are absent. When things are absent, then there's room for a lot of other things to be present. I've met some people in Burma, some monks in Burma. And I don't know if they were completely free of clinging, but they were pretty free. And boy, were they all different. And there wasn't one quality or character. The absence of greed, aversion, and delusion gives a lot of room for different expressions of freedom. That makes me happy. What is the expression of freedom? What is the expression of non-clinging here in this being? It doesn't have to look like some idea I might have. In another sutta, the Buddha describes kind of the internal dimension of his experience, a mind that is not clinging. Also, in this description, it's mostly in terms of what is not happening, not what is present. It doesn't describe it in terms of great states of bliss or love or vast, empty space. It doesn't describe it in terms of what is, but in terms of what is not happening in the mind. Well, here's the Buddha's description. There's not that many descriptions in the suttas where the Buddha describes, like, this is what this mind is like. This is one of those. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata. Tathagata is the name by which he refers to himself. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. And he goes on to describe a little bit more about what this means. A Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. Likewise, for an audible thing apart from hearing, a thing to be sensed apart from sensation, a Tathagata does not conceive of a cognizable thing apart from cognition, does not conceive of an uncognized, does not conceive of a thing worth cognizing, does not conceive of a cognizer. Not conceiving, pretty much in any way. Not conceiving. So what is conceiving? The texts relate both conceiving and papancha, that term we talked about the other day, as related to the mental formations of craving, wanting, conceit, the sense of being superior, inferior, or the same as anyone, or views, ideas. And so this state of non-clinging is a state in which these mental formations are not arising. Again, the absence of craving, conceit, views, non-conceiving. In another sutta that describes a more ordinary person in terms of conceiving, it says, an ordinary person perceives the seen as the seen. Having perceived the seen as the seen, one conceives oneself as the seen. One conceives oneself in the seen. One conceives oneself apart from the seen. One conceives the seen to be mine. One delights in the seen. Why is that? Because the seen has not been fully understood. So this is connecting this conceiving with this kind of this process in a way of selfing and othering, this separation of self and object. When we talked about explore the other day with papancha, the objectification, the creation of an object, and that simultaneous with that creation of a thing is a self who is separate from that thing. This together, those two coming up. Maybe papancha is kind of more focused on the creation of the object, and perhaps conceiving more the creation of the subject, the one who knows, sees, feels, senses, the illusion of that. The division into self and other. This morning, Gil used at the end of the guided meditation, what is it to be undivided? That, what does that evoke, that sense of not being divided? So this description of an ordinary person describes or points to a number of different ways that we tend to relate, that the sense of self that is created tends to arise in relationship with experience. One conceives oneself as the seen, in the seen, apart from the seen, conceives the seen to be mine. These different flavors of relationship. I think this is where perhaps a little bit of reflection or exploration might support us. How do we conceive? How does that separation happen? So those four ways that the Tathagata does not conceive, the Buddha describes his own mind. Let's look at each one briefly with the idea of the flip side of it. How white might we be conceiving? And what might we learn from that possibility of not conceiving? Maybe being aware of the tendency to conceive, which is such a subtle kind of process in our minds. I think we're not usually aware of it. Not usually aware of this tendency to conceive a visible thing as apart from sight. So a free mind, one without clinging, does not conceive of a visible thing as apart from sight. That's that separation, that idea making that there is a thing, perhaps. This is my own kind of understanding of this, you know, just my reflections on this. There's a sight seen, and the mind without clinging understands it's just a process of seeing happening, not constructing a representation, not constructing the idea or believing the idea of a thing apart from the seeing itself. The seeing itself is the seeing. No division. Not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, an audible thing apart from sound, a cognizable thing apart from cognizing. The Tathagata does not conceive of an unseen. This one's kind of sat in my mind for a while. Not quite sure what this means. A few kind of resonances for me. And this is a lot how I work with these kinds of teachings. It's like, what do these words, when the mind becomes a little more still or quiet, sometimes these words, which don't seem to make that much sense, or we don't really consciously understand what they mean, sometimes they can land in a way that opens the mind to seeing things in a new way or understanding things from a different perspective. So this isn't the way I offer these teachings today. These words from the Buddha, these words. What can we learn from just letting them in to resonate, go in like that Dharma rain? How might it land? Does not conceive of an unseen. There are two ways that this has resonated with my own sense. Sometimes flipping it around, how might I conceive of an unseen? You know, what might that mean in an ordinary mind? If the Tathagata is a mind that does not conceive of the unseen, this mind probably conceives of an unseen. So one way that I kind of reflected on this is like, I might not. So conceiving of an unseen is like, if I haven't seen it, if I haven't actually experienced it in some way, then there could be a little bit of a belief that it doesn't exist. So a kind of a belief about things not seen. So an example of this might be that story I told about the gorilla and the basketball study, where some of the people in the study who didn't see the gorilla believed they would have seen the gorilla, and so believed that the gorilla did not exist in the video that they saw, conceiving that their perspective on what was seen and not seen was the truth. So that's one way. I haven't seen it, so it doesn't exist. Maybe we have that conception in our minds. I think this is also the reflection on this particular text I find useful to reflect on from, you know, how might I conceive a visible thing apart from sight? How might I conceive an unseen? Another way that this conceiving of an unseen occurred to me, I kind of reflected on this as a little bit of a tickle in the mind in some way, that as we start to see or recognize that what we are experiencing is created by the mind, there's a palpable feeling of that at times, that, yeah, what I'm experiencing is not what's out there. It is constructed by the mind. There could come a kind of an idea or a belief. Well, then, if all that I know is the construction by the mind, is what's constructed by the mind, that means there isn't anything out there. Maybe, maybe not. But the Buddha, in some places, the Buddha really encouraged us to not take up views as being true, conceiving of this experience, that what is known is entirely created by mind. There's nothing out there. That's a view. There's something out there. Is a view. There's nothing out there is a view. What might it mean to not hold a view about that? Again, I just offer these as reflections. The Tathagata does not conceive of a thing worth seeing. Conceiving of a thing worth seeing is like that. Oh yeah, that craving, the craving around what is seen. That's a good thing to see. Maybe that's not a good thing to see. That sense of craving and not craving, craving and aversion, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing. Craving not arising. Does not conceive of a seer. This one is so prevalent for us, conceiving of a seer. Who is seeing? Who is knowing? Who is smelling? Who is tasting? That sense of a seer, a smeller, a cognizer, a thinker. Now the Tathagata does not even conceive of this. Does not conceive of one who sees, one who hears, one who knows. There's a sutta many of you are probably familiar with, the Bihiya Sutta, which expresses something like Bihiya comes to the Buddha and asks for instructions on how to train the mind. And the Buddha says, you should train yourself like this Bahia. In the seen will be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the sensed, only the sensed. In the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. And so the training, in a way, I've read some scholars say that the sutta that we're looking at here, where the Buddha describes his own mind absent of conceiving around seeing, hearing, sensing, and cognizing, that this sutta could be described as a little bit of a commentary on the Bahia Sutta. How might it meet? What might it mean? In the seen is only the seen. And the seen is only the seen is when one does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. In the seen is only the seen. And yet the Buddha says you should train yourself like this Bahia. Train yourself that in the seen is only the seen. And probably we're not going to be able to flip the switch and say, stop conceiving. So maybe the encouragement is to notice the conceiving that's happening. Get curious about how there is this conceiving of a separation of sight and one who sees. Now there is a sense of a seer. Get familiar with that. Maybe that's the instruction from the Buddha to Bahia. Not to try to stop doing it. That trying to stop doing it would probably be a sense of self trying to stop it. But just to recognize, when is there something in the way of just in the seen is only the seen? This conceiving is in the way of that. And so maybe this exploration is to look at, where are these separations? Where are these divisions? The remainder of the Bahia Sutta goes on. When for you in the seen is only the seen, the heard only the heard, the sensed only the sensed, the cognized only the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. And so this exploration shifts the mind to the understanding of not self in the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized. After describing his internal experience in the sutta, the Buddha goes on. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, and sought after, and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. This phrase, not taken a stand, this is a phrase that just kind of comes into my, when my mind is quiet. What does it mean to not take a stand? Not take a stand on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. This not taking a stand to me means kind of, again, the sense of not creating something to try to stand on. Taking a stand, you know, we usually think about like landing somewhere. And there isn't anywhere to land. Things are changing so rapidly. Every experience, rising and passing, arising and passing. There isn't anywhere to stand. The creating of a stand is a reification, a kind of a misunderstanding of the experience. Not taking a stand. There's another sutta that really connects the experience that is happening for us every single moment as just being so unstable. Consciousness comes to be in dependence on a dyad. In dependence on I and forms, there arises I consciousness. The I is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Forms are impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Thus, the dyad is moving and tottering. Impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The I informs almost immediately something else. Nothing stable in the I informs. I consciousness is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The cause and condition for the arising of I consciousness is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. How could I consciousness be permanent? Our usual kind of way of thinking of taking a stand relies on some sense of permanence, some construction of that idea. And when we really meet experience, there is nothing to stand on. The Tathagata does not take a stand on it. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. The next phrase in the sutta, the Tathagata being such like in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, is such. This word such in the Pali is, it's a simple word. It means something like such or that or this in an ordinary way. But it's used in the suttas to point to maybe the kind of the mind that is completely aligned with the experience as it actually is. Experience arising and ceasing, the consciousness, the mind knowing it arising and ceasing. Nothing other than those processes, just those processes arising and ceasing. Thus, such. The processes create and experience what is experienced. Nothing else going on. The processes creating experience and experiencing the experience. There's another translation of this word such, which is an interesting counterpoint to this exploration of the Tathagata not taking a stand. This word for such, tadi, is the Pali, is often translated as something like stable, firm, steadfast, immovable. And so from one sentence to another, the Tathagata does not take a stand on that. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, being ever stable among these seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, the Tathagata is a stable one. The Tathagata does not take a stand, but is stable. This is almost a little paradox in our minds. Our usual idea of stability is having somewhere to land. So this kind of paradox, or these two words, these two phrases coming together, what does this evoke? What might it mean to not take a stand and be stable? When we reflect on the tottering of every sense experience, the tottering, the instability of the sense experience, of every moment of experience arising and passing away, arising and passing away, what does it mean to be stable with that? For me, there's a sense of there might be a sense of space in which things could happen, but even that space, maybe an idea, the stability of space, there's a kind of a flavor for me at times of the experience being so slippery, nothing to land on, nowhere to stand, but being nothing other than that slipperiness, there's no problem. There's another analogy about this stable one. It's the analogy of a mountain. Suppose there were a stone mountain without clefts or fissures, one solid mass. If a violent rainstorm should come from the east, it would not make it quake, wobble, or tremble. If a violent rainstorm should come from the west or from the north, from the south, it would not make it quake, wobble, or tremble. So too, when one is perfectly liberated in mind, even if powerful forms cognizable by the eye come into the range of the eye, they do not obsess the mind. The mind is not at all affected. It remains steady, attained to imperturbability, and one observes the vanishing. Even if powerful odors cognizable by the nose, powerful tastes cognizable by the tongue, powerful tactile objects cognizable by the body, powerful phenomena cognizable by the mind come into the range of the mind. They do not obsess the mind. The mind is not affected. It remains steady, attained to imperturbability, and one observes the vanishing. Ceasing of experience. A mind of non-clinging. Nothing to hold on to. Everything, when it arises, is recognized as ceasing. As a single mass of rock isn't moved by the wind, even so all forms, flavors, sounds, aromas, contacts, ideas, desirable and not, have no effect on one who is such. The mind still, totally released, observes the passing away. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the end of this. No forms, tastes, sounds, odors, and tactile objects and phenomena, desirable or undesirable, stir the stable one's mind. The mind is steady and freed, and one observes its vanishing. And that nowhere to land and stable. Nowhere to land and stable. Not affected by the arising, watching the ceasing. Not affected by the arising, watching the ceasing. Maybe at times there could be a little bit of an evoked sense of what it might mean to be totally released. There's another sutta that brings in kind of a way to, in a stage way, kind of the way we've been describing, notice where you have a taste of non-clinging. Recognize that. What is it? What is it free of? What is it free of? This particular sutta describes a process where you can kind of start by recognizing what kind of agitation is not here right now. I think Gil brought this in the other day. We can reflect on a number of kinds of agitation that aren't here right now, and that can give us a little bit of the flavor of some non-clinging, some release from our habits of mind. So we're not subject to the agitation of a lot of parties and conversations about things outside, that agitation is not present. Maybe we can connect to that. Oh, phew. Don't have to have that right now. Get a flavor of the absence of that kind of clinging. And the teaching points out that, you know, noticing that absence of that clinging, I know, like we might get a sense of, oh yeah, that feels pretty good not to have that kind of agitation present. And maybe there's a little bit of landing with the ease or peace of that absence. And as we hang out, appreciating the absence of that kind of agitation, the mind begins to attune to what's here and maybe begins to recognize, oh, yeah, that's absent. That kind of agitation is absent, but this agitation remains. There's some remaining agitation here. It's like the falling away of the more obvious agitation has created a space in which we can then land and recognize, well, yeah, there's a little bit of subtler kind of agitation here. Not to judge it, not to, you know, have a problem about it, but just like, oh, okay, now I can see some subtler agitation. And the process kind of works that you open to that. Oh yeah, that agitation remains. The seeing of that agitation allows a kind of a letting go. Can create the conditions in which that agitation releases. And then we understand, oh, free from that agitation. That's not here now. And in that quieter space, there may be revealed some quieter, subtler agitation. This is process deepening. We don't usually become free of our clingings all at once in one big explosion. I used to think that's what enlightenment would be. It would be a split second moment after which I was suddenly now completely free. And it's much more gradual than that. This process describing a very gradual kind of letting go, letting go, letting go, seeing where there's what's absent, seeing the freedom that is here, kind of appreciating that. And, you know, with that support of seeing that, that level of letting go, oh, now I can see where there's still some clinging, kind of a gradual wearing away of clinging. We can see perhaps the letting go of a certain level of agitation, no longer taking a stand with that. Oh, but where am I taking a stand? Maybe that lets go. Oh, no longer taking a stand with that. I'm gradually becoming stable amidst the arisings and ceasings of experience. The last thing I'll bring in is an image that I just remembered from I think it's Joseph created this. He may have learned it from someone, but this is where I heard it from. And he described the way the practice unfolds as a kind of an analogy to doing skydiving. And, you know, you go up in the plane and probably a little bit of like nervousness and what's that going to be like when I jump out of the plane? And then, you know, you get to the time where the pilot says, okay, time to jump. And you look out the window. It's like, am I really going to jump into the air? Am I going to let go of the plane, let go of the plane and jump into the air? And you do that. You let go. You jump into the air. And initially there's a sense of exhilaration, perhaps, a sense of, oh, what a relief not to hold on. What a relief to just feel this experience of falling. And, you know, I got my parachute, so I'm okay. And then you realize that you don't have a parachute. And so there's fear, terror, sense of anticipation of the contact, the landing. And then Joseph says, and then you realize there's no ground to land on. There's nowhere to stand. No ground. Just endless slipping through experience. That's my kind of image with this stable and nowhere to land. No ground. No ground to land on.